Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am your co-host, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. I'll kick it over to my esteemed co-host.
Your other co-host, William Gadsby-Pete, Chief Strategy Officer at Literal Humans. Yeah, I'm excited for this one.
And we have an amazing guest today, CEO and co-founder of Bea Fertility, Tess Kosad. Welcome to the pod, Tess.
Hey, Paul. Hey, Will. Great to be here.
I have to shout out the lovely background that you have, the stained glass window. It's I think you're outshining most of our other guests in terms of that background there.
I claim no credit, I'm afraid. These firmly belong to a friend who I'm cat-sitting for, so I'm living my best life right now.
Nice. Probably our first guest with a stained glass window background, I think. Is that right, Will?
I don't know. I mean, we've had some fancy people on this pod, so something that we've seen.
Yeah.
How many cats are you sitting for?
2. So the staff to cat ratio is not looking good over here.
We hope one slinks across the keyboard at some point. We welcome it. We're pro animal, despite our name at Literal Humans. Today we're going to be talking about inclusive fertility care, and Tess, you run an innovative femtech company that's dedicated to making fertility care more accessible and more affordable, so we're super pumped. It's not something we talked about much in the pod, but we're looking forward to diving into it. Tess comes to the show today with a deep passion for addressing inequality in healthcare. You've led Bea Fertility to develop the first at-home intracervical insemination kit. Give us a quick note, like what exactly is that for folks who aren't well-versed in ICI?
Yeah, ICI is the acronym for intracervical insemination, Paul, and it was sort of the de facto, you can kind of call it the OG fertility treatment. And what ICI is essentially it takes sperm and it places it up against the cervix using a little cup, a silicon cup called a cervical cap, where you leave it in place for an hour. And so it's a really simple form of fertility treatment, but the beauty of it lies in the fact that it works. So it actually does deliver pretty incredible efficacy, but for a 20th the cost of IVF.
And curious about that, just sent a note to our design team asking them to put together a graphic showing how ICI works, which I'm super excited about seeing. So could you give them a little bit of, I don't think we've done any designs involving cervixes, so I'm very excited to see what they come up with, but just give us a little bit, more about kind of why this type of procedure is so important and why you decided to champion it at Bea Fertility.
Yeah, so I can help out with that. I have, here at Bea, we have a family of vaginas. Ursula is our uterus model. She's fantastic. Nice. And I can certainly help you with medical models that help show what happens inside the body with this treatment in the kindest and least graphic way possible. So I think the reason that we championed Bea and decided to sort of bring ICI back and bring it out of the history books and modernize this treatment is because we saw an IVF industry that was rapidly driving towards commercializing IVF. Hmm. And IVF, the science of IVF is really magical, but actually the business practice around IVF is completely manipulative. And we see people spending $61,000 on average out of pocket in the US on IVF. And in the UK, it's £13,500. Now, if you don't have that, what are you supposed to do? Like, how do you create your family? What treatment options exist for you? And the more I sort of looked at the IVF industry, the more I thought, my goodness, we've got to do something about this. And that was really the genesis behind Bea.
That's amazing. Well, that work that you've done, just to give you a shout out, has earned you a spot on the Health Tech World's Incredible Women in Tech list for 2022, recognizing your contribution to the femtech industry. So congratulations on that award. How did that feel?
Thank you very much. I laughed when I saw it, honestly, because Bea often gets branded as a femtech company, which is, which is in essence correct. Women drive most of the buying decisions in the fertility journey. But really, if you look at the technology, if you look at the core of what we've built, it's a sort of giant sperm optimization stick. So really it's Mentech. So anytime we get awarded for anything related to femtech, I laugh. I love it and I laugh. Mm.
Mentech is something we've not dived into Mentech yet.
I was just gonna say I've obviously it makes sense because we know femtech exists, but I'd never realized there must be a whole Mentech sector.
Well, this is it's so wonderful, and Will, it's interesting that you point it out. There's a ton of Mentech in the world. Hims, manual, anything related to over-the-counter erectile dysfunction, right? It's Mentech, but we just call it tech. Now, I got called a female founder. Paul, I don't, do you get called a male founder? So we attach the label in an interesting way. It just, yeah. Anyway, the label makes me laugh a lot.
Well, I didn't think there was another way to give VCs out there boners, man boners, but we just invented one by inventing a whole new category. So yeah, I feel like we can talk about boners since we're talking about cervixes and stuff. Yeah,
I'm really glad that you used the term boner before I did, Paul, because you've given me the green lights to speak as I normally do on
please,
this pod.
Please, let's have it. Cool. I want to dive in with our first question here. I want to talk about femtech because we can table man tech for now, but bring it in as needed. Just to give some stats, you know, 2021, we saw global VC investment in femtech exceed $1 billion for the first time. So that's an exciting development. Some of those funding rounds included LV's $70 million Series C, Flow's $50 million Series B, and Clue's $16 million round, which is really exciting. So it seems like femtech is expanding beyond fertility to include menopause, endometriosis. I have an ex-partner who's dealing with that, and that was a big learning for me about, you know, what a lot of women go through in terms of endo and all that entails. These areas have been historically underfunded. So just curious to understand, as femtech's expanding its focus and kind of addressing these broader areas that have been underserved in women's health, we've seen a lot of innovations in personalized healthcare. What do you see as the biggest challenges and opportunities within the sector? And how do you think it'll change lives for women and LGBTQ folks out there?
It's such a good question. I think the sector I honestly think the sector is poised to explode. And it is exploding, right? Like, look at the size of these rounds. We're really seeing validation that technology that's built for women and technology that addresses the needs of women is so completely pivotal. You know, in the US, they refer to the matriarch, the woman in the family, as the chief health officer of the family. You know, she's making all of the buying decisions. She's making all of the care decisions, not only for herself, but for her children, and often for her partner and for her aging parents. So she sits at the core of not only her own life and needs, but the lives and needs of everyone around her. And I think we need to start to recognize that femtech is not just about the needs of the individual woman. It's her life experience, and the people that she cares for along the way. And I think the minute the sector and investors start to realize that, and creators in the industry start to realize that, it's just going to explode. I think I'm so excited. I think the opportunities that face us here are incredible. And for me, one of the core challenges, especially in the field of healthcare, is how do we integrate into the healthcare system? So we're seeing some incredible innovations in at-home diagnostics and testing, tampons that can pick up STIs and gynecological testing, vaginal microbiome swabs that screen for everything under the sun. And these are incredible technologies. But if you take that test and you get those test results and you take them to your doctor, your GP in the NHS, they will look at those results and they will say, I can't do anything with this. You know, so the integration between the innovation and the existing healthcare system to enable the person on the receiving end of that innovation to actually do something with the insight, that's going to be one of the core challenges as I see it moving forward.
I love that description of women as the chief health officer of their families. I mean, that again, that's definitely something that the tech sector and the VC funding sector can understand. You know, they love a C-suite, right? So, but I think like shifting that branding and that marketing to let's really consider like the buying power and the relational power that women have inside families is a good way of like framing it and helping folks understand, you know, how women are positioned in such a powerful spot within their families as it relates to femtech and fertility care. So that's really great.
Totally. Couldn't agree more.
A guest we've had on the pod previously, Cynthia Fortledge, has a great line about like this and the potential, where she's like, women are the only minority who aren't a minority and yet get treated like it's like this niche sector that's and actually it's 51% of the world. So it's like, yeah, the you know, the fact that the market's only $1 billion is actually kind of wild if you think about it.
It's a really interesting thing that you bring up there, Will. I think the number of times I heard along the fundraising journey, like, oh, fertility is niche. Well, hold on a second. The global prevalence of infertility in the population is 17.5%. Now, to put that into context, the global prevalence of cancer is 1.3%. And yet the oncology market is $200 and whatever billion. And the fertility market is valued currently at sort of just shy of $50 billion. And so I think when we go to label things as niche, go and benchmark against other things that aren't necessarily tainted by the whole minority argument. And you see a totally different story, actually. And you start to see these huge opportunities that exist in the gaps.
I'm glad you brought in the lens of MenTech and it overlapping with FemTech. And I think we've seen, you know, there's been a focus on like cycle tracking and reproductive health, particularly for FemTech. And it's, you know, excluded some critical health concerns that address women, sexual dysfunction, pelvic floor weakness, sexual health education for LGBTQI and trans community, menopause, dementia, and cervical cancer are just some examples of those that have been considered kind of awkward and uncomfortable by investors. So how have you sort of overcome that and you know, reach the milestones that you have, convincing investors, convincing folks to receive your product and embrace it?
It's a really good question. I think with Bayer, when you're struggling with infertility, it's such an acute pain point. You know, we haven't necessarily built a vitamin here. We've built a true painkiller in the sense that when you want to get pregnant, you are not in your desired state. And the longer that you are not in your desired state as someone who's experiencing infertility, the more the frustration grows. And people really sort of seek out solutions. They really want something that's going to solve their problem. And so I think from our perspective, if we can get the messaging and the positioning right, and if we can build a product that is usable, that works, and that has credibility, it's really a question of finding those people who need that solution. In terms of investors, it's certainly been an interesting ride, I think, trying to raise my pre-seed round. I'm sort of very much a first-time founder, and I'm sort of really open and candid about that. I think it's so important to be open. I've sort of listened to episodes where we heard people from Sifted, and look, I love Sifted. Sifted is fantastic. And if you look at Sifted, everyone who goes out to raise knocks it out of the park with these incredible raises. If you just read the headlines on Sifted, what we don't see is all of the rounds that didn't happen, you know? And I think when I was prepping to raise our pre-seed round, I'd never raised before. So it's like, oh, let me do a bunch of research on Sifted. Let me read Brad Feld's book 3 times. Let me understand what warrants and lick prefs are. And then let me go and raise. Oh boy. Does the theory not prep you for the reality? I think I had something like 284 conversations to get a cap table of 15 people. And it was such a brutal experience. I think it really hardens you in an interesting way. And I think as a female founder that's non-technical, raising for the first time for a medical device that is not built, that is consumer facing ultimately in a category that investors did at the time and still continue to brand niche, that is like no investment bingo card right there. And it's been a really interesting experience trying to convince people. You know, after our pre-seed round, the cap table was 50-50 male-female investors. And I was fiercely proud of that. Yeah, fiercely proud of that. But early on in the round, I got really frustrated. And I remember I turned around and I just said, you know what? If you cannot say the word vagina without stumbling over it, you are not getting onto this cap table. And that just became the hard, fast rule. So I find a way to slip the word vagina into every conversation I have with prospective investors.
I'm just picturing you in a room of like, you know, mostly white finance bros who went to like Oxford or Wharton or something like that. And you're just throwing out pelvises and vaginas and cervixes and sperm. And they're just getting increasingly squeamish in their chairs. And, you know, but it sounds like you've pushed through that.
Paul, just wait until we start talking about cervical mucus.
Oh, man. Well, you've done an excellent job penetrating the market. I picked that verb specifically. So kudos for that. And we wish you the best moving from pre-seed to seed, obviously. And yeah, I agree about Sifted. It's interesting. You read all the success stories and very few of the horror stories, unfortunately. So kudos for pushing through there.
Thank you.
I'm not psychic, but I work the word vagina into every conversation with investors. Might be getting clipped and put on social. We'll see what happens. I don't know if you guys have ever seen like Gen Z TikTok mocking LinkedIn. But I feel like, not in a horrible way, a lot of the same things kind of apply to Sifted, where it's just like, I am success. And you don't see the 200 conversations that ended in no for that one conversation that ended in yes.
Well, what's ironic is that Sifted ended up doing the exclusive on our pre-seed round. And suddenly we were one of those headlines. And I thought, oh gosh, how do I reconcile being the headline that I was so sort of confused about throughout the process? It really made me laugh. There have been many moments along this journey that have made me sit back and just get some perspective and then laugh.
Just taking it over to like the, you kind of mentioned it earlier about just the prohibitive cost when it comes to fertility treatment. Like, what are some of the other big challenges and barriers that, you know, folks are facing and that you hope Bayer helps address?
Yeah, the barriers are, there's so many, right? I think principally the way the industry is constructed is fee for service medical care. Right. So like in no other sector of medicine would we see the level of privatization and commercialization that we see in the fertility world. If you needed cardiac surgery, you wouldn't be given a 10-page brochure with all of your options, with unnecessary, unregulated and unproven treatment add-ons that the clinical team is saying, oh, you should totally get this add-on. It's totally going to improve your chances. But there's no data, by the way. But in fertility, that's what you get. And so I think the barriers in the industry as a result of the fee for service are for principally prohibitive costs to the end user. Who has $61,000 stashed behind the couch to pay for IVF? And then the question becomes, well, I've got this baby, but it's definitely not going to go to college after we paid money to get it. What kind of trade-offs are people making? So you have the cost as a barrier, then you have stress. You know, financial stress, emotional stress, relationship stress. We see tons of research that suggests that infertility is possibly one of the most stressful and traumatic things a relationship can go through. And then I think you also have sort of the emotional stress around the IVF process. You have all of the hormones. A lot of people come to us and they say, I cannot put my body through that again. I can't do it. You know, those hormones are no joke. And so I think the barriers to pursuing IVF are really enormous. And the industry markets IVF to us as though it's kind of the natural next step in the process if intercourse isn't working for you at home. But IVF really, if you look at the medical pathway, is the last step in the treatment pathway. It's your only option. If it doesn't work, there's nothing after that. And so I think for me, one of the biggest emotional barriers is making the last step in the care pathway the first step in your family building journey. And that really feels like a big mental blocker for a lot of people we speak to.
Like looking at some of the stats around fertility, like one fifth of men in the UK think fertility is a women's problem. I'm really glad we're talking about this subject in particular. It's something that's near and dear to my heart. I've been a donor for three different families and have kind of walked them through that or walked with them through that experience of, you know, one family experience an immense struggle and you know, turned to IVF, and it still continues to be on that journey, and you know, two other occasions it was much easier. Yeah, and
incredible. So, I mean, I know you're the one asking the questions here, not me, but I mean, gosh, tell us about it. I'd love to hear more. That's incredible.
Well, just to say, like, it was a real education for me as a man to just kind of, yeah, walk with those families on that journey. And I think, you know, seeing one process that was fairly easy, one that was like kind of middle of the road, and one that was quite difficult in terms of fertility and sort of understanding my place, you know, as sort of circumspect and somewhat removed as a donor, but just like understanding the myriad challenges that come up from, like, you know, safety and testing and going through the clinic route and the expense of it, the immense expense of it. So it was something I wish, like, gosh, not that every man needs to be a donor, but like, it just made me think, gosh, I had to be a donor to kind of fully understand what women in particular are dealing with on their side when it comes to fertility and in some cases, you know, older births or, you know, geriatric pregnancies and things like that. So it was just all that to say, really fascinating. And it made me grateful for programs like yours. And there's some, you know, really cool clinics that we dealt with in the States and around the world that I think are doing really good work in that area. So
that's incredible, Paul. I mean, look, we sort of haven't even touched on it, but the LGBTQ families and journeys in the fertility world that we see, so women working with known donors, is one of the principal groups of people who benefit from the Bayer treatment because there's no intercourse, of course. Mm-hmm. So you try finding a female couple and telling them, oh, you can go to a clinic and pay £800 for your donor sperm, or you can find a guy on a website and figure it out. And it really just feels wrong. And actually the very first baby born of this technology, she's a little girl due the first week of May.
Wow.
And she's coming to two fathers and their surrogate. Well, they had a surrogate, they had their setup, they did all of their tests. They were sort of really responsible in their approach. And indeed the clinic said, oh, well, you know, you have a surrogate coming into IVF, but of course they don't need it. Yeah, they don't have a fertility problem. And so when we launched, they were the first buyers, and their baby will be the first coming up soon. So anyway, all of that to say, really cool to hear that you've been a donor. That's incredible.
Yeah, no, I'm grateful for the experience. And in all cases, they've been, you know, LGBTQ families. And in all cases, I've subscribed to being a known donor. So that's an exciting part of it, too, is like getting, as the child gets older, getting to have a relationship with them, be able to tell them about, you know, a bit of their biological family and stuff like that. So I'm very, very grateful to have been in
wow,
that.
Wow, so, Paul, what a journey. I'm so excited by that. It's Not often that I'm rendered sort of speechless with excitement, but that's incredibly cool.
Yeah,
I love that so much.
I appreciate that. I think it's a good segue to some of the, in some cases, troubling developments that have happened in women's reproductive rights over the past years. We've had what we've seen in the States in terms of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. There was a concern that came after that in terms of cycle tracking data being used to kind of, you know, catch women and convict them for reproductive crimes. In the great state of Alabama, we just had this ruling that frozen embryos are now people, and, you know, the implications for IVF patients, of course. And people tend to think of these as like American problems, right? But we, you know, there's even trouble in the UK in terms of, you know, what's been called medieval abortion laws. So just curious what you think about the impact that these events are going to have on the fertility sector globally, and what role fertility companies can play in advocating for reproductive rights and access.
Yeah, I mean, the US exports their culture, right, globally. So if it's starting there, I think we all just need to keep our eyes open and be really, really cautious. And it's so easy to look over the pond and think, oh, well, it's not going to happen here. But it can, and it does. And it's so important to be vigilant and to keep fighting. I think, you know, the developments in Alabama, what scared me so much was some of the language used in the ruling. If you actually read the ruling carefully, not only did it reference religion and religious passages in a Supreme Court ruling, but it used words like cryogenic nursery and extrauterine children. And it just used this language as though it was totally understood and common vernacular in the industry, when actually it is not. An extrauterine child is not a thing. Mm-hmm. An extrauterine child is you and me. And, you know, we're extrauterine children. We are children no longer in the uterus.
Yeah.
But a child has to be in a uterus before it can be extrauterine.
Mm.
So calling embryos extrauterine children is so dangerous. Calling a lab and a cryogenic storage tank a cryogenic nursery is so dangerous. And what really deeply concerned me about the ruling was the introduction of language that loads up that ruling and makes this journey so much harder for everyone else. And I think when you're going through IVF, if people start calling your embryos extrauterine children, imagine if one of them isn't viable, one of them, you know, doesn't progress. When you're referring to it as a child, that it adds a weight to the process that simply doesn't need to be there. And I think what we can do as fertility companies is be crystal clear in the language we use as we describe what is going on inside and outside of people's bodies when they're trying to build their families, irrespective of the treatment that they're going through. You know, be clear, be transparent, be kind, be scientific in the way that we describe these processes. It's a small thing to do, but boy, in the face of that ruling, it's a start.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, I think that's something that the right does particularly well. They develop new language to rope in populations and like hook, you know, voters. It's scary. And I'm sure those phrases you mentioned have been focus group tested probably by Frank Luntz or someone like that. And just kind of they're rolled out, you know, to kind of how do we get, you know, attach words that people care about?
Exactly. Like, how do we introduce scientific legitimacy
that
is in line with our agenda? And people on all sides, I think, end up doing it. But there's a really scary, scary sort of undercurrent behind this ruling that is control. And it's pretty horrifying, honestly.
Yeah. One thing to add, it's not all bad news, I would say. So we've seen some promising developments, you know, at least in the UK, there was the removal of safety screening that cost up to £1,000 that was making IVF treatment less accessible to same-sex couples. So now that's been lessened and it's now more accessible. The government, you know, in the UK is seeking women's views, shocker, on, you know, policy issues that actually affect them. And in 2022, they published the first women's health strategy for England to kind of help tackle the health equity and access gap. So not all bad news. We like to highlight some positives, and obviously we'll get into this more, but amazing, you know, femtech companies like yours who are rising to the occasion and delivering services that frankly the government should be more involved in, arguably. But yeah.
Oh, totally. And rulings like Roe v. Wade and the Alabama ruling only light a fire under the people who will step in and develop technology, innovation, solutions to sort of fly in the face of that. And so I think it can only be the beginning of good things for innovation as a ton of people get real angry and start working on it.
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic segue to our next question. You're nailing the segues, Tess, so thank you for that.
heard a lot of awesome stuff about the actual product, but would love to hear about like kind of your personal founder journey, how you ended up deciding to get involved in this space, and yeah, what it's been like. We've already heard about some of the fundraising travails, but what's the journey been more like for you personally?
Yeah, it's been a real trip, Will. It's I think nothing can prepare you for starting a company. It, you know, male, female, whatever you want to be, however you want to sort of identify and be as a founder, nothing really quite preps you. And I think that's, I'm reminded of that probably every single day. I think with Bea, my journey, it's certainly not been a linear journey. You know, I started the business in 2020, and then my co-founder George joined me in 2021, and then we sort of built the team from there. And I think I never actually honestly imagined I'd get into fertility. It wasn't something that I was put on this, that I thought I was put on this earth to do. But I think something that's a common thread in a lot of things that I do is I cannot bear things that are not fair. And you just have to sort of nibble at the edges of the IVF industry to realize quite how, goodness, I'll say it, Paul, you started, monumentally fucked this industry is. It is honestly bananas. And so in 2020, I was kind of knocking about working actually as a sort of chief marketing officer for tech companies. And at my core, I think my skill set was sort of really storytelling and positioning and branding. And that was really what I was bringing to B2B tech companies, honestly, you know, oil and gas, mining, you name it, we were doing it. And I really felt the need to do something that mattered. And the more I looked at fertility, the more I thought, my goodness. And then you start to have friends who go on fertility journeys and you think, wow, why is this so hard? And then you look into the genesis of the industry and private equity and funding and how it's all sort of emerged since the 70s. And I thought, my goodness, I've got to solve this problem. And honestly, I think we used to talk about it with new hires. I really don't actually care that much if people are motivated by fertility when they come to Bea. But I really challenge you to sit through a user interview with someone going on a fertility journey and listen to their story and not come out of that desperate to solve that problem and make that pain go away for them. You know, so if you come out of that desperate to solve that problem, you're on the team. And I mean, I think my personal journey, we're all just sort of trying really hard to solve this massive problem. And look, laugh along the way, right? Like, there's the time that we fired mayonnaise across the office ceiling trying to do a semen test with a competitor product. There's the time I dyed my vagina blue because we were testing fake sperm for the product for an FDA test. There's the time I cried the whole way in a cab back from our first gynecologist appointment where I literally had a pelvic exam so that he could photograph my cervix to check that the product actually worked inside the body. And it did work. And I was so relieved and so excited. And it was raining so hard that I got in a black cab back to the office and cried the whole way. I think the cab driver thought I'd been through like some kind of horrible breakup or whatever. And he drops me off all concerned. And meanwhile, I've spent the entire cab ride with a photograph of my essentially vagina, trying my best to like sort of pixelate out the parts that I might not want the team to see so that I could run back to the team and be like, guys, we did it. We did it. And so there are so many moments that I just look back and I laugh. I throw my head back and I laugh and I think, my goodness, what a trip. And the highs are so high, the lows are so low. And as a founder, I think you're unprepared for the amplitude of this journey sort of gives. And it's just been a really cool ride. It's been a really cool ride, actually. And honestly, I don't really probably ought not to say this in public, but if it all went wrong and it all went away tomorrow, hell, we've made 33 babies that we know of and a ton more coming. And that's quite a thing to be able to say. So it's, I suppose that's a long answer to your question there, Will, but it's been a trip.
That's more interesting than most of the personal journey questions answers. dyed my vagina blue as a highlight, definitely.
It has gone back now. It has gone back. But I did remember calling an OBGYN friend of mine. And I was like, Ben, I need you to tell me that this is not permanent. He's like, a few weeks. And I just died.
Tess, I want to thank you for anticipating the follow-up question and not making us ask it in terms of what color.
How long did it stay blue?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a good few weeks, guys.
Well done.
A good few weeks. Tell you what, there are more Smurf memes in the world than you think.
Yeah. Wow, okay. I was gonna say you join the annals of history, of scientific history, of like testing the product on yourself, testing the new invention on yourself to some degree. I think the great Albert Hofmann, the inventor of LSD, for example, he took a bit and then went on a bike ride. So, you know, I think he probably cried at some point, similar to your experience in the cab. But yeah,
I'm sure he did. Yeah, I'm sure we've all been there. If you're working on something that matters and you don't cry en route.
Yeah. If you start a business and you're not crying in a cab on the way home from a meeting or to a meeting at some point, have you really started a business? I think that's the key question there. Yeah, we've definitely had a few of those moments. So, well, I appreciate you sharing your journey, and as Will said, it was one of the more interesting journeys that we've heard about from founders. That you know, none of them I think to date have mentioned their genitals, so we're really grateful for that. But we want to hear what advice you might have for aspiring femtech founders and you know, folks who are hoping to follow in your footsteps and learn from, you know, the trials and travails that you've been through. I know you're early in your journey, but what would you share for other folks looking to innovate in the femtech space?
Yeah, I think there's one thing I learned that's sort of a gender neutral learning shock along the way early on, but I can't claim credit for this lesson. This came from a very, very, very dear friend of mine who's built and sold 4 companies. So, you know, statistically nigh on impossible. And he said, look, Tess, make decisions. Your only job as the CEO, because you know all of the context, is to make decisions. You know, when you get to an intersection, left or right, really, it doesn't actually matter, because if you take 3 lefts, you end up where you wanted to be anyway. It might take longer and it might cost more. And sure, it might sink you along the way, but decisions are the only opportunity you have to course correct, to move forwards, or to learn. And if you're not doing one of those 3 things every single day, take a look and start making some decisions. And I think that would probably be the one thing that I wish someone would have told me earlier on. Doesn't matter if you get it wrong. It matters that you make the call, because then you can make your next call.
Yeah, and I want to appreciate kind of where you sit within the history of really women founders, women inventors. There's this massive issue of fewer women getting patents. And I think there's a great quote from Science. That's the magazine. There's a report in Science just about sort of like patents by women focus more on women's health, but fewer women get to invent. And I think that's really important. So, you know, there's a quote in here. The inventor gender gap is partially responsible for thousands of missing female-focused interventions since 1976. More generally, our findings suggest that who benefits from innovation depends on who gets to invent. And I think that's really key. So like the fact that you've done this and you're empowering other women to, you know, be inventors, be creators, be founders, I think is really, really stunning and really inspiring. So I look forward to pushing this podcast episode out to, you know, hopefully hundreds, if not more, aspiring femtech founders and getting them inspired by your story, which is really, really something. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Will. It was honestly such a deep pleasure to chat to you both. I loved it.
So yeah, I just want to thank you for jumping on the pod. And just if you can, let our audience know where they can find out more about you and more about Bea Fertility. We're on the interwebs. Where is that?
Of course. So beafertility.com, BEA. And honestly, if you're struggling with fertility, if you want to chat anything, if there's any way that the Bea team that I can help, email me. It's really simple. Tess@beafertility.com. Just send me an email. I love it so much. You know, if this is a problem you're facing, I want to help you.
Nice one. And to the investors out there, get comfortable with the word vagina. Tess is coming. Okay. I want just fair warning. All right. Awesome stuff. Well, thank you. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. We've had the wonderful guest, Tess Cosad, CEO and co-founder of Bea Fertility, doing amazing stuff, inventing the world's first at-home intracervical insemination kit, ICI. Go check it out. Thanks so much for being on the pod, Tess.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All you fans out there of Tech Can't Save Us, please shout us out, like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating. We really love it. It helps us bring on wonderful guests like Tess here. So thanks, y'all. Have a good week.